Hello and welcome to Battle Rattle Radio, hosted by OD Journal, a division of TACCOM Media. You're listening to Triple D and Christopher Larson from One Shepherd. Chris, you probably want to take a chance to say hello. It's been a little while.
Hello, and thanks for that. Yeah,
absolutely. For those of you that have actually found us again, we have changed our format. You probably heard quite a few shows that we put together when we were part of a small part of KCXL in Liberty, Missouri.
Right. No, we were with Liberty, Missouri for. Honestly, was that about it? It was two different networks at 11:40 a.m. KCXL, and we were there for a little over a year, I think. Right?
Yeah, started out with KCXL Sports, and then went over to the JPEG Sports, but both of them a part of 11:40 a.m. KCXL there in Liberty.
Right. I mean, you know, you got to be appreciative of that. That's where Battle Rattle got its start, and they were a great company to work with. They certainly were. Of course, that was back when we were doing everything live.
Yeah, well, you know, and it was a unique environment, certainly. You know what? Yeah, right, it was a great company. And a live radio wasn't interesting. Certainly, we had to, I guess, basically make our plans in the saddle, so to speak. But now we're here, and we are podcasting, and we're going to be using OD Journal, of course, as our host. And this is a new format for us. And, Chris, you're particularly pretty excited about this new system that we're using.
Well, yeah, I mean, come on. The great thing about podcasting, of course, is that... You can make mistakes. You can have, we'll just say bloopers, and then you can come back and cut that out and cover it up or do whatever. You know, you can also go on a tangent, as you and I are very prone to do. You can go on a tangent, and if you later decide, wait, that's not relevant, you can go back and cut that out. So I think in terms of production, there's a lot of advantage there. You can explore a great deal more. But I also think in terms of convenience of the audience. Again, not to talk disparaging at all about 11:40 a.m. KCXL. They were just a great company to work with. But the downside was that it was a live performance. And so if you weren't turned in and tuned in Sunday evening, then you didn't get it. So going to podcast means that, of course, now we can reach a nationwide, even an international audience. So that's really exciting.
I think so, too. You know, and so much of what you're doing is instructional in nature, so it also provides a resource that they can go to at any time. They're not, like you said, they're not limited to Sunday nights, but I mean, at any point in time, as far as a studying resource, you can go back and
of course, that's that's the motif there of Battle Rattle so much as ODJ, is that it tries to be a multimedia resource, as you said. It's a training resource, is really what it is, or I guess I should say a learning rather than training. Yeah, it tends to say what the instructor's doing. Learning is what the learner is doing. So, yeah, it's a learning resource, and very much it's attempting to do that. I think that's why it's just a natural link, or it's a natural connection. OD Journal already has, it's establishing itself as, text articles and multimedia articles and, galleries and things like that, as well as it sells in its library. It sells, the different books and publications or DVD productions, you name it. So this is kind of a no-brainer. It just makes sense then to put Battle Rattle Radio with ODJ. I think it does anyway.
Sounds like a good matchup to me, and I'm happy about the format too. I think it's something that we're going to grow into, and certainly the editing possibilities make my job a lot easier, so we got to love that too. But even going back to the live radio days, and here, now that we're podcasting and OD Journal is hosting us, the basic, content, the message isn't changing. We talk about military doctrine, particularly at the small unit, squad level.
Right. I mean, the effort is really to focus on the tactics side of it. And we hope, our intent is... to bridge then. You got to constantly bridge back up at least one level up to the operational level of warfare. And if we're really doing our job well, we talk about, what they call it? They call it the strategic corporal, how things happen at that squad, fire team, platoon, company level that impact strategy, a national diplomacy and stuff. So we do need to, if we're doing really well and doing a good service, we're talking about how tactics not only bridge to operations, but also impact strategy. Here the effort is, OD Journal really is an effort for that fire team leader, the squad leader, platoon sergeant, platoon leader, company commander, first sergeant, that sort of thing. Regardless of what you're doing it or how you're doing it. I mean, frankly, I don't care if you're law enforcement or security contractors, whether you are one of the proud service of the many men and women who defend our nation, or frankly, if you pursue the warrior path. To say that I don't have a problem with reenactors or milsimmers isn't going far enough. I think I actually have a profound respect for that. They're still pursuing the warrior path every bit as much as, say, one of your mixed martial artists are, or maybe, even you have Olympian archers and marksmanship and NRA marksmanship. I think these guys and these men and women, I salute them. I mean, I really do. I have a great deal of respect for them because they are pursuing that warrior path, regardless of which motif or which model they're pursuing.
You know, it's funny. You know, you talk about pursuing the warrior path, and those are philosophical. They're bigger terms, and some may say they're outside the box. But again, you know, going back to what we've done in the past, and what we're going to be doing here in just a few minutes, and continue to do on future shows here on Battle Rattle Radio, and that is, you know, you break down some of the tactics and you see the specifics of pursuing that warrior path. And I think, you know, there's a lot of innate aspects about it, about the warrior path, but it is a process at the same time.
Oh, no, there's no question about that. I mean, you look at any martial art, and again, whether you're talking about Taekwondo or whether you're talking about, IDPA, the International Defensive Pistol Practical Shooting Association, I guess is what it is. IPSC and IDPA kind of go hand in hand. There is a process, and they mirror each other. I don't mean to say that they're identical because they're different art forms, but nonetheless, there is a process that you can identify. I don't care which martial art you're in. You will identify that process. And that's true. I'll go you one farther. And a lot of people will kind of laugh and yeah. No, I'm serious. If you're one of these reenactors or milsimmers that take this seriously, you do go through that learning process. And it's not weeks or days. This is years. Even farther, it can be and often enough becomes a lifelong pursuit.
Well, I have no doubt. I mean, you know, we've done so many different shows covering different tactics, and it's an encompassing thing. To really, just mentioning tactics. You said, well, what are tactics? What are military tactics? Boy, that'd be a difficult question to answer in less than 1,000 pages.
Well, you know, what's funny about that is I've had people come to the One Shepherd training, different seminars, different training events that we hold, and simulation events, of course. But I've had them come there, and one of the things I like to do towards the end of a training weekend is called develop in Kolb's learning cycle and stuff. But what that really means is, that's academic speak. What it means is you turn to your client who you've been with for all day or maybe 3 days or whatever it is, and you say, okay, refresh your memory. Here's what we've talked about, blah, 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 over the last, so many days. How are you going to use that? And you get predictable responses, and that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing. It may be a little mundane, but you get those predictable responses. Well, the next time I'm on a patrol, I'll do this, this, that, and the other thing. You also get hit with things that you're just not expecting. And, you'll hear somebody say, well, I love basketball, and I'll do this different. And they're taking the learnings from our tactical art, and they're applying it to things that you just wouldn't have thought of. I'm going, basketball? But it makes sense. You hear these guys talk about it, boom, 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 and I'm like, wow, I hadn't connected that. But what's even cooler than that, I remember one time I had at one event, we had a guy who's the CEO of his own shipping company down in Georgia, and when I said, what's your takeaway? He started talking about how this applies to his business. He's in a shipping business. And I was like, wow. I mean, that was very welcome, and it was rather profound, but it caught me off guard. Another time, in a whole different event, we're talking about that, and I turned, and I said, okay, what's your takeaway? And this guy says, well, you know what? He's probably mid-40s. He says, I have two teenage sons. And boom, and he goes into this whole thing about how this changes the dynamic of how he talks to his sons. So I know I'm going out. I appreciate that. Triple D's kind of looking at me like, uh-huh. No, but I appreciate that that's taking it a little farther. But what I am saying is, it's not a big stretch that you'll see a lot of the principles of tactics and leadership and decision making, not so surprisingly, have application to other parts of our lives. And who knows, maybe that's really why we pursue this as its own art form. I don't know. But yeah, you get some really cool surprises there.
Well, you know, and not to get into too many specifics, of course, we say that, and then we kind of take a dive off the deep end. But, you know, you mentioned leadership right there. And I think a lot of those things, if you look at something that, you know, as far as a core concept, that you definitely, one shepherd deals with leadership.
Oh, yeah.
All day long.
Sure.
And, you know, then you start applying it to things like, well, is there a leadership hierarchy in a corporation like a shipping business? Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Is there leadership in being a parent?
Oh, yeah.
All day long. So, you know, then again, when you think about it, I mean, if there's a core principles or a process that is, you know, one thing it has in common, certainly would be in leadership and also problem solving and task accomplishment.
Sure. You know, this is one of the things Triple D has heard me say time and time again, and I'm going to keep saying it. I'm going to sing it. It's my mantra. And it's a big thing that guys in One Shepherd hear all the time, whether you're one of our student members or whether you're a client, you hear me say it. And that is that leadership is a universal art form. It is an art form, and it applies across the spectrum. Management, then, is industry specific. Now, the funny thing about that is I don't know a single industry, including the military, that says, well, leadership can be separated from management. That's not true. They are inseparable. They are entwined and cannot be removed from each other. But the paradox there, the duality of that is that management really is rather process-oriented. One could argue very scientific in its approach. And again, it's process-oriented because it's specific to that industry or that endeavor. You talk about parenthood and stuff like that. There's management. But leadership, the principles of leadership aren't industry specific. They apply whether you're a parent, whether you're a librarian, whether you're a general or whether you're a corporal, whether you're a business owner, whether you're a school teacher. I mean, they just are universal principles. And so I think, you know, it's no secret then that in One Shepherd, 50% of our student body, and we're getting ready to celebrate our 30th year at One Shepherd, no kidding, 1981 to 2011. We're getting ready to celebrate our 30th year here, and 50% of our alumni, and we're talking 300 plus people over 30 years of our student alumni, 50% go on to military service. But, you know, what's even more profound about that to me is that 50% don't. They enter the business world, the corporate world, the academic world. And so, to me, that just vindicates what I'm saying, what I've been saying all along, and that is that leadership is universal.
Well, you won't get any argument out of me on that. It definitely is. It's a universal, I don't know, I wouldn't say a philosophy or a tool or
yeah, kind of all of the above, really. But yeah, I like the idea that it's philosophic and
it's an equation that fits in.
Sure.
And works. And so now getting down to the nitty gritty, when you were talking about leadership, let's stay with leadership. We always pick something in the way of tactics that we want to cover each show, and I think it's time to get down to the wire with it if you're ready.
I'm ready.
All right, Chris. Well, we've done a show on this before, but it's one of my favorite aspects of tactics, certainly at the small unit level and definitely at the command level. But one crucial aspect, I suppose, of your leadership coming from your commanders, and that is, of course, commander's intent.
No, you're right. It, in fact, if I were going to say you really want to get down to the soul, the heart and soul, whatever, I would say it's the very soul of the leader is the ability to express their intent. Now, the military has this thing they called VDD, Visualize, Describe, and Direct. And it's an acronym that kind of shows what's the activity of a leader. But until you have you know, and that I think appropriate to Commander's Intent, because Commander's Intent does say, suggest that you have this, you can visualize what you want done. Okay, then you have to be able to describe this to your peers, to your subordinates. You have to get everybody on board. And then that's the direct. You know, how do you facilitate this getting done? So you have to have that vision, and Commander's Intent talks about how we express the vision. It doesn't necessarily talk how you gain that vision, but nonetheless, it gets to the very soul. Commander's Intent. Look, you can have a great idea, but until you can express that great idea, that idea is rather just intuitive in your head. You know it, but you don't know yet how to vocalize it, you know? And so this applies again, all leadership does. This applies even if you're an entrepreneur. Well, we teach on the military model because, frankly, it has sex appeal, right? I mean, it's cool. Guys like this sort of thing. A lot of people are attracted to this sort of thing. But nonetheless, you know, we use the military model. Okay, fine. The military calls this ability to describe your vision. That's your commander's intent. Now, Triple D and I are over here, Battle Rattle Radio, very, very close to Fort Leavenworth. Now, Fort Leavenworth, of course, is known for one of the premier mid-career schools. It's a 10-month course for the U.S. Army called the Command and General Staff College. It's an operational-level warfare. Okay, school. Again, being tactics, then operations, and then strategy. And so these officers, these majors, come out here for 10 months of their lives. They come out and they learn operational level warfare, you know, operational warfighting. And they've gone to these students and they say, it's great stuff. I've seen this online. I've seen it in newspapers. And they ask these majors, all right, what's Commander's Intent? And it's funny listening to them describe this. They say, well, it's this, that, and the other thing. Some of them have it down in a line to a description. Some of them go on for, you know, a page of written material saying, Commander's Intent is this, that, this, that, this, that, this, that. And the funny thing is, Commander's Intent has to be incredibly short. It has to be incredibly concise. It's a concise description of the commander's vision. That's probably it, the most effective way of saying this. And yet, it's really hard for a lot of warriors to get their head wrapped around that. It has to be a concise expression of that vision. If it's not, it becomes quickly convoluted. And so I remember I was teaching over at the Human Terrain System, and I was teaching all these anthropologists, you know, these social scientists, and they're saying, yeah, what's Commander's Intent? Well, it's a mixed class. You know, you wind up with 35 people in this class, and I'm giving a two-hour course on Commander's Intent. Well, one of the comments I made, and I honestly believe it's what I was taught as a young soldier. I was told, look, Commander's Intent has to be so concise that 24 hours later, if your corporal cannot repeat it verbatim, then you don't have a Commander's Intent. Let me say that again. A commander's intent has to be so concise and memorable and intuitive that 24 hours later, your troops better be able, if someone says, hey, what's the commander's intent? They better be able to express that virtually verbatim. If they cannot, then you don't have a commander's intent. Now, I said this to the class, and it was really cool because in the class, you not only have the social scientists, but there's a real neat mix of contractors, which are veteran soldiers, and there's also soldiers, I mean, uniformed soldiers there, of everything from, you know, enlisted to NCO to officer to senior officers. And so I had like a major and a lieutenant colonel, it seems to me at the time, say, hey, Chris, listen, that's really cool that you got that. But, and we're not saying you're wrong, at a tactical level, you know, down there at the rifle company, you know, 125 guys, you know, or the platoon, 30 guys, or the squad, 9 guys. Of course, a squad leader or a platoon leader, their commander's intent needs to be remembered verbatim. Yeah, we're on board with you. We're not saying you're wrong. But you have to understand that at operational level, a battalion, a brigade, you see, you're moving 3,500 troops. You've got close air support, you've got artillery, you have joint, you have liaison officers from the Marines, from the Air Force, all this stuff. You probably have foreign army, foreign military liaisons there. Look, you can't sit there and give three lines of a commander's intent and have meaningful information for all these diverse groups. You know, you just can't be done. And so I didn't agree with them, but they're saying, they're explaining, and I kind of went, all right. Well, listen, that's my understanding. Well, there also happened to be a retired two-star general in the room. And he listened to this major and this lieutenant colonel tell me that. And, of course, you know, they were graduates of CGSE. And I have to admit, I got big kudos and some real vindication because, of course, this general stood up and said, hey, you guys, you know, you've told your side of it, and I appreciate that because everybody needs to hear that. You know, those social scientists, they need to hear the complexity of the operational fight. However, he said, I'm going to side with the young sergeant here. Of course, General Ward knew that I was a former NCO. And he says, I'm going to side with my young sergeant here. And he said, I'm going to back that up by saying that General Dwight D. Eisenhower, before D-Day, his commander's intent was 18 words. 18 words. This guy sent 250,000 troops on a joint task force from, I don't know, let's guess, 12 different nations speaking God knows how many languages. He sent 250,000 in on the first day with the largest flotilla the world has ever seen. And his commander's intent was 18 words. So when a battalion commander comes to me and says, look, I'm a battalion commander. I've got 800 troops that I have to, you know, provide a commander's intent for, or two. I can't just do this in three sentences or one sentence. You know, I'm going to have a full typed out page of commander's intent. And so I hear that and I think, no. Not only because, of course, Dwight D. Eisenhower is on my side. And if a five-star general doesn't, you know, give you a bang for your buck, then nothing will. But not only because of that vindication, I think really it comes down to this. The pragmatic side of it is this. No one can remember the nuances of a typed out page of commander's intent. And they're going to need to. They're going to need to remember this because the whole function of commander's intent is that when the plan breaks apart and is no longer feasible as the commander envisioned, you've got some squad leader sitting there, some young lieutenant, 22-year-old lieutenant, some 21-year-old squad leader sitting there going, oh, whoa. Well, we're not going to do this as the plan said, so what was it the commander wanted us to get done? And now you're trying to remember a typed page that you saw 3 days ago? Come on. It's just not practical.
Well, that's why it has to be specific.
It
but,
does.
You know, and when for me, I think it helps sometimes, and you have to be careful about paraphrasing and using different terms, but I mean, it seems like it's an end state.
That's part of it. That's very much part of it.
What do I, you know, the commander's intent, what do I want to see happen?
That's right. That's absolutely right.
But at the same time, it's concise and specific, but it's not a matter of this is what I want to see happen and this is how I want you to do it.
Ah, right. That's where you get prescriptive rather than descriptive. Remember the connotation anyway, perhaps the denotation. Descriptive means I'm describing the conditions of success. When I prescribe it to you, I'm telling you which tool to use, who's going to use it, and when. And a commander's intent must avoid being prescriptive. It must be descriptive. It must describe the conditions for success to get to that end state. And that's really your two of the three critical pieces of a commander's intent. There's one more out there, and that is, why? Why in God's green earth are we doing this? You know, there's all these great myths about the military. Ours is not to question why. Ours is but to do and die. Ah, hogwash. In fact, the commander's intent explains exactly why we're going to do this. So really, that's it. in a very concise, you could even do it in a single sentence, or you might do it in three concise sentences, but either way, you're going to give the purpose, that's the why, the key tasks, those are the conditions for success, and the end state. Purpose, key task, end state. Boom, boom, boom. That's commander's intent. That's exactly what commander's intent is. Now, again, the magic of that is that the purpose tells the subordinate, hey, this is why we're doing this. This is why it needs to be done. Key tasks, that's a little bit, you know, that term, when we hear task, well, I'm telling somebody to do something when and with what. No. You don't say we're crossing the river with pontoon bridges. You say we need to cross the river. That's a condition. Not when, where, how.
But you do have to tell them why we're crossing the river.
Right, sure. We need to know why we need to cross the river. We need to know that we need to cross the river. And we need to know what a description of the end state. What does success look like? What does it look like on the battle space?
So it could be somewhat task related, like we need to cross the river, do this, and come back.
Sure.
That's our end state, is when we've accomplished this and we're back. But it may be we're going to cross the river and we're going to set up defensive positions and maintain the other side of the river. So that's an end state. And you just have to explain why, and you're there.
You know, I was out at the National Training Center out in Fort Irwin, California one time, and our company commander was having a hard time. Now, this, understandably, he was under pressure. He wasn't a bad guy at all, nor was he a buffoon, nothing like that. But he was struggling because there were these OCs, these evaluators, you know. And we had a mission to do. And he was trying to describe that. He said, look, there's this valley over here, and we have to clear this valley. And he's trying to talk it over, and he's explaining it. And one of the senior OCs, you know, he's a captain, and there's this major who says, or I think it was a lieutenant colonel. Anyway, the point is, he said, just give him your commander's intent, sir. Well, what I want is 2nd platoon to do this, and 1st platoon to do this, and 3rd platoon to do this. And he was just fuddling it. I mean, he was messing it all up. And I even started, I thought it was a pretty simple mission. And the more he went on about it, I got more and more confused. Wait, hold on. You want us to... Wait, where's 1st platoon? You know? And so I was getting lost. And finally, this lieutenant colonel, this OC, gets so frustrated. He's like, sir. He turns to the captain. He says, sir, just a commander's intent. 3 simple sentences. Purpose, key task, end state. Come on, how hard is this? He steps right over to the terrain map where there's this valley with these 2 parallel ridges. And he said, purpose, you've got to clear this valley so the supply train can come through at 8 o'clock in the morning. Key task, you're going to have to own the terrain on these 2 high grounds in the valley. We currently think bad guys have it. End state, the supply train gets through to our good guys up north. Was that so hard? But the answer is yes. Yes. This is something that you can learn, but is very difficult to teach. Purpose, key tasks, end state. The supply train has to get through. We have to clear and hold that high ground so that supplies get to our sister battalion up north. That's your commander's intent.
And it's always all 3.
And it's always all 3.
And then I think the beauty of what you see with the system, you know, in the military system, is that once you have an accurate and well-delivered commander's intent, then you already have a network of NCOs that are going to go out and start putting together plans and running missions and gaining intel to accomplish those tasks.
Well, yeah, absolutely. It's called the nesting, right? So the company commander says this is what it is. And then he turns to, you know, and then he turns and he gives his plan. Remember, he still has a plan. But the commander's intent is giving me the down and dirty. So that if his plan falls apart and is no longer feasible because, hey, don't forget, Mother Nature gets a vote. That's weather, terrain, darkness, right? Did a tornado? Yeah. Did a tornado come through? Did it start snowing in the high grounds? You know, whatever. So Mother Nature gets a vote. But the enemy gets a vote. And I don't care how brilliant your plan is that we get so vested in and married to. The enemy doesn't want to see us, you know, our plan come to fruition. So the enemy is going to try to subvert that. Now, if and when those subordinate leaders then look at the ground and they say, hey, look, I got boots on the ground here and the plan is no longer feasible, they still remember the purpose, the key task, and the end state. They can go about achieving those with a whole new plan, winging it. You know, in effect, commander's intent gives soldiers, subordinates, the authority to disregard your orders. Think about that. Think about that. I mean, that's, in the military model, things are life and death. Okay? It's not about whether we're profitable or not. It's life and death. To give subordinates the authority to disobey orders is an incredible thing. Incredibly profound. And I mean, you just think about that. You go, whoa, that's what a commander's intent is doing. Now, it's not saying the commander doesn't come up with a plan and that we're not all going, okay, that's the plan, let's go with the plan. But it's saying if this plan is no longer feasible, that's what's going to happen. Where does that come from? That comes from the tradition of German, of all things, the German tradition of Auftragstaktik. Again, Auftragstaktik, which I think the literal translation is orders tactics, as opposed to the earlier form of missions tactic. And missions tactics, the German army in World War I was very, and prior to it, was very specific, very prescriptive, because they said, look, this is our mission, and this is what the general says we're going to do, okay? Orders tactic, it's very subtle, but it's not so subtle, the meaning. What it meant was, okay, here's what we hope to achieve. Now, let's let our subordinate leaders have some authority and say so in this. And this was profound. It wasn't well received at first. But it didn't even come initially from the Germans. It came from, I know it's hard to do this, it came from the French. Now, we all want to make fun of the French, and rightfully so. But you know what? You have to give the French due. As much fun as it is to tease the French military actually has a very proud tradition, in all fairness. It does. And during World War I, the German army was far more impressed with the French army than any of the Commonwealth armies of the British or even the Americans. The French were really much more agile. And so the French would send their huge formations of 70,000 troops forward against the Germans, or vice versa. The Germans would send them against the French or the British or what have you. And these huge marching squares would walk into concertina wire that would stop these massive formations of human squares. And the machine gun and autocannon would just mow them down so that the carnage was unimaginable. I mean, there are stories not just of you know, small rivers of blood flowing off these farm fields, but that the soldiers died so clumped together that they couldn't lay down and die. They laid in squatting, kneeling, sitting positions, bleeding out and moaning against their friends. Unimaginable carnage. And the French, after seeing this go on for months and months and months, said, you know what? There's got to be a better way. And that's what we all do. We all look now back at 100 years ago and we say, gosh, why were they doing it that way? Well, the French even then saw this is not working. Instead, let us send a rifle squad tonight before daybreak, hours before, and they will cut through the Germans' wire very quietly. They'll cut a small little path, shoulder wide. And then right before daybreak, we'll send the rest of their platoon forward to make that wider and just secure the toehold on the enemy side of the wire. Now at daybreak, we'll release the rest of the rifle company, who will use microterrain and little ravines and ditches and shell holes, and they'll, in ones and twos and fours, they'll maneuver up to that breach and they'll fill in and attack the trench line and secure the initial trench line. As soon as they do that, we're marching an 800-man battalion in there, widening the gap. will seek the communication node of the opponent, of the enemy, and then we'll shove, once an 800-man battalion has got the toehold, we'll shove the whole 70,000 in. And they did it. And they did it multiple times, and they did it with overwhelming success. And the Germans took notice, and they said, "What in the world was that? My God!" They were reeling from this. And they watched, and the reports came in, and they said, "Whoa, something is very, very different about this." And they looked. Now, here's the thing about French engineering and French thought. They're artists. They are. They're truly artists. And when they have a recipe, they don't share the recipe with the rest of the neighborhood. They husband that information. Because making that meal that way made them unique and special. It was proprietary in nature. They husband the information. So what the French did very well was breach the enemy, the German line. But what they didn't do well was institutionalize it. They didn't teach other French units how to do this. One commander was successful, and he enjoyed that alone. Germans, by contrast, took that notion right away and said, "Yeah, let's institutionalize it. Let's train it. Let's teach everyone right now." And from that came Auftrag's Taktik. Auftrag's Taktik was brilliant. It was a 3-star general turning to a squad corporal saying, "Corporal, I'm imparting upon you the authority to make decisions. Even if those decisions counter my orders, directly disobey, as long as you are operating in good faith of my intent." If you're operating in good faith of the commander's intent, you will never be punished for disobeying the orders. Powerful stuff. Powerful stuff. Just, wow.
Well, you know, it's funny. The thing about, and we'll talk about this in future shows, of course, because we talk about, well, for any task, a raider patrol, there's a planning phase. And planning and planning. And boy, if you've ever been involved in an Op 4, or anything along those lines, you plan and plan and plan, and we're not even going to get into rehearsing.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
you rehearse and rehearse and rehearse, at least as much as you're tactically allowed to.
Sure.
But the funny thing is, and everybody, you know, it's so interesting to take part in, I think, because you from the command and on down, your chain of command, everybody to the squad level and fire team level, they're all aware of that one basic concept that the plan is probably going to go wrong.
Yeah, isn't that great? You expect failure.
Yeah, you expect failure. But it matches up with what you're talking about as commander's intent, because how often does that happen when you've got so many different variables? There's probably nothing less digital and more analog than warfare anyway.
Right.
So when all the plans go out the window, you still have that, well, I know what my intent is. It's chaotic right now. I don't know who's who. I've lost track of my fire team leader. I know what's going on right now. Or like you said, if we're taking high ground, but there's snow on the high ground now and there's traction issues, whatever the case may be, but I know what my intent is. I know what my commander's intent is.
You just have that incredible focus on the objective. You know, you have that incredible focus on the objective. And you have to understand that the Germans, you know, a lot of people look and they say, why were the Germans more successful in World War I? Now, we all know they lost, but why were the battles so lopsided? And then you see that again in World War II. You know, we see the Germans in the last half of World War II just, you know, falling back and being defeated and defeated and defeated. And both World Wars end in defeat, but particularly in World War II, but even in World War I, what's more amazing is look at the first half. Look what this tiny little impoverished country, this impoverished nation, look what it achieves. Look at the landmass that it influences. And so, I mean, we say, how is that possible? You want a staggering statistic? In World War II, for every one German soldier killed, there were 7 Allied soldiers killed. 7-1 ratio. That's a staggering statistic. And we say, how is that possible? It's because, you know, and people want to tell you, well, they had very sophisticated, you know, close air support. They did well with their artillery, you know, support. They had better panzers and all this. Or their rifle arms, you know, their machine gun was superior. Bunk. I mean, not necessarily untrue, but I think it had far less to do with that and much more to do with the fact that the German army, through Aufturcht's tactic, through commander's intent, developed an NCO corps. They developed a corps of non-commissioned officers at the tactical level that they relied on to get everything done. That was the magic. And that is certainly what the United States Army copied. And we all know this. I think the irony is, as much fun as it is to make fun of the French, the Germans didn't create it. It was actually the French army that created it.
The Germans just took it and ran with it.
Yeah, I think they perfected it.
Well, you know, I think it's funny when you read some of the doctrine about them encountering, you know, the Allied troops encountering the German small unit tactics and how they were at the tactical level was not just psychologically, you know, I don't know what the right word for it is, intimidating.
Yeah.
But was incredibly alien. They weren't used to, on the tactical level, just the vocality of it, the ability of the NCOs to direct traffic right on the tactical battlefield.
Right. Now, I mean, to credit the United States Army, we've had a strong NCO corps since our inception. In fact, predating the 1775 birthday of the United States Army, the NCO corps existed before that. The United States Army's NCO Corps. That's ironic, and that's another piece of history. So we've always had a strong NCO Corps, but this notion of commander's intent, wow, powerful, powerful stuff. And again, it empowered the authority of the small, subordinate leaders, all subordinate leaders, and certainly NCOs and junior officers, where, frankly, today, most of the previous Commonwealth tradition, I don't mean the current British Army, because certainly they do that, but I'm saying the Commonwealth tradition, the Soviet model tradition, red team armies, they don't. They continue still not to empower their NCOs or their junior officers. They're afraid to. They're afraid of failure, and they believe these people aren't trained well enough, aren't educated well enough to make those kind of decisions. And so, I'll give you an example. This is something I heard years and years and years ago when I was studying up to go I was an advisor to the Iraqi infantry battalions in 2003, 2004 during the war. And I studied up. And one of the things it said about Arabs, and I found this to be incredibly insightful, not just true, but again, very insightful, is they said that an American platoon sergeant, E7, an American platoon sergeant, had as much lateral decision-making authority as a lieutenant colonel battalion commander in Arab armies. Or I don't care which Arab army you're talking about. A battalion commander in an Arab army had the same decision-making authority as a platoon sergeant in the American army. Again, top-down leadership versus this dispersed team leadership.
Would you say that the commander's intent, the advent of it being used on the tactical level, would you say that it changed warfare?
Oh, I think you can't argue anything but that. I think that this, the maneuver warfare that led up to static warfare. You know, you see the Napoleonic lace armies that put an enormous emphasis on maneuver, that is, cavalry squares maneuvering with infantry squares, you know, and caissons pulling up the artillery. And then you see it go to this static warfare, right? And that's often called, the static warfare, it doesn't matter what they call it, Gen 2. And then what introduced, and then in the static warfare, we're literally talking about World War I. World War I is in many ways the beginning of modern warfare, but it was static. It was linear in its entire nature. And so the effort all through World War One was to add dynamic back into the calculation, to add maneuver back into it. And by no, it's not a mistake that born from World War One was maneuver warfare, modern maneuver warfare. The tank, the aircraft, close air support, close artillery support allowed all, maneuver to have the advantage again. Remember that during most of World War One, the defense had the advantage in technology and power. And maneuver warfare allows this blitzkrieg, allows the offense to have the advantage again. And so how do we get from maneuver linear warfare, static warfare, to maneuver warfare? And the answer is, you say, well, it was planes and tanks, of course, and flamethrowers. No, it was commander's intent. It was commander's intent and the greater reliance on the smaller and smaller unit. Now, I don't want to be naive about this. Smaller and smaller formations of troops were making very important decisions and changing the battle space, thereby having impact on operational level warfare and having an impact on strategic level warfare. That's why we call them the strategic corporal now. But I don't want to be completely naive. It is the mechanization of warfare and the mass firepower that a infantry squad or platoon or company now has in modern warfare that gave that. So it's really kind of a 1-2 punch, I think. It goes hand in hand. Yes, the authority to make decisions at the small unit level, rifle company and below, was instrumental.
And that is not dependent upon technology.
Well, no. But I would say this. If you go back 200 years ago when you've got muzzle-loading, smooth-bore firearms that have a range of 60 yards, right, and fire 3 rounds per minute, as opposed to modernization, rifled weapon systems that have very sophisticated high rates of fire and everything else, this puts such a massive amount of power into the smaller and smaller formations that it became, I think it's no accident, then it became, okay, now I'm not going to move a square of, 100 or 700 infantry. I'm not just going to move that square across the battle space. I can now move 30 troops and have the same combat power. So that meant, whoa, before we had to give a lieutenant colonel the decision-making authority, now we've got to give that to a lieutenant or even a sergeant. Yeah, I think they kind of go hand in hand.
So maybe, it's which came first, the chicken or the egg.
Yeah. But critically, I mean, it was important that it changed. And we know which came first. I can tell you which came first. The technology came first. And what it resulted in was absolute carnage.
We have to change.
Yeah, we have to change.
Something had to give. It seems like, of course, I'm a big Sun Tzu fan.
Sure.
Which actually, if you've read it cover to cover, and I don't, of course, he obviously doesn't use the nomenclature of commander's intent.
Sure.
But the sentiment of what you're talking about is out there.
Absolutely.
Sun Tzu was definitely in tune with an end state.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, he had a lot of great tactics as far as, attacking the enemy where he's weak. And what's funny is he was very humanitarian in a way.
I think he was, yeah.
I think when you see people deter away from a lot of his basic tactics, that's when you see a lot more bloodshed.
Right.
You've seen it historically throughout war history. But, when you think about the... I'm with you on it. I think that, the technology certainly leads up to that. But I think independently had, you see if somebody would have revolutionized that, if there would have been a military man out there that would have done that in an earlier historical period, and even with the technology they were dealing with, there would have been some radical results. You certainly saw it with the Roman army, which was brilliant about the training and a chain of command, so that if one commander actually gets removed from the battle space, that his next in command could step up and had the training and was able to continue to function.
Sure.
Which was a key part of that in itself, radically changed military history and military warfare in general at that time frame. So then you think about something fundamental where you're empowering at the tactical level a fire team leader to disobey an order and say, okay, well, this obviously isn't going to work. I can't run up this hill this angle, but we need to get the hill. That's the intent, so I can run around. You know, I mean, I'm obviously coming up with arbitrary ideas. You know, it's much more complex than that. But I just think it's funny. There's a certain sort of irony as effective as commander's intent, as the positive effect that it has on the battlefield, is that how crucial it is. Because I have a funny feeling that, that warfare hasn't changed that much over the centuries, and that is that axiom that whatever plan you have is probably going to be obsolete after the first 3 seconds after the first shot is fired.
Sure, that's Klaus Witt. You were talking about Sun Tzu, one of course, the most recognizable military philosophers. And then there's Clausewitz, of course, equally as recognizable as Sun Tzu. But what's Clausewitz's famous quote? No plan survives the first shot. There you go.
And what a void is left. If you didn't have commander's intent, what a void.
Right.
What really happens then?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's funny, you were talking about that the different types of leadership approaches to this. And I read once that a good leader convinces people. I mean, truly convinces people that he or she is a good leader. People around them have wonderful confidence in this leader. That's a good leader. A great leader convinces other people that they're good leaders. And if removed, when removed from the equation, a great leader, their goals are still achieved.
And certainly commander's intent is the vehicle for all of that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
sharing that vision. It gets back to sharing that vision. You know, you want to talk about some really radical, and this is a different, we'll have a different class on, or I mean, excuse me, a different class, there I go. We'll have a different show on leadership styles, but to throw one out there, transformational leadership very much does this. Transformational leadership is, a bit of a paradox of itself. You know, it changes so radically that it's often, in most cases, not well received, but it tries to change. And one of the key factors of transformational leaders is that they instill in the subordinate leaders the ability to carry on without them. Throw some great transformational leaders out there. Jesus Christ, Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Martin Luther. You see, the movement can go on even without them. They're so brilliant because they take time to foster and mentor other leaders and explain to them, you are a good leader. But you're absolutely correct. The vision that's expressed through commander's intent very much is there, very much is present.
Oh, you know, you talk about the ability to empower, you know, like you said, at all levels. Those are the steps that you take to foster that leadership. I mean, it obviously it's task specific. I'm going to give my commander's intent because this is what I want to see. This will be the end state. But, you know, individually, if someone on a fire team or a squad leader or a platoon sergeant says, okay, we're going to change, I'm disobeying this order in order to get this intent accomplished and accomplish my commander's end state, what he or she wants, those are the steps you take to become leader. You see what I'm saying? That's a big leadership move. Things like that will give you experience at the same time. It's not just task specific to that very battle. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, yes.
It's a teach a man to fish, give a man a fish kind of thing.
Right, and I think this is, you know, that gets back to excellent leadership. And we talk a lot about commander's intent, but what we forget is that what goes hand in hand with that is the phenomenon you're talking about, I believe, is called commander's presence. And that is, you're right, again, let's get back to our young lieutenant on the battlefield, and he says, wow, the commander's plan is no longer feasible. I know the commander's intent, therefore I'm going to execute. Well, that young lieutenant, what's going to help him immensely is not merely knowing the intent, of course, that's the most critical, but also knowing the character, the quality of person his or her commander is. I mean, that's that. Now, you say, well, commander's presence is what? Is achieved through having a barbecue, a cookout, and some beers. Okay, sure.
Possibly.
Sure. Those are called icebreakers, and every new commander comes in, does that. And they do. But it's Commander's presence is far bigger than that. It really gets down to the type of leader that, you know, the leadership style, the leadership approach that Commander takes, and the command climate. There's another word or term for you, the command climate that they foster. You know, is it an ethical, is it a morally just climate that they, you know, or are they backbiting, you know what I'm saying? There are cultures historically, if we look back at, you know, you mentioned the Romans, there are periods of times that the Romans went through where they were stabbing each other in the back figuratively, if not quite literally. And there was a command climate then that went along with that. Is my commander ethical? Oh no, he'll sell you down the river in a New York minute. And so you create those kind of climates and you project a presence. And if it's one that people trust and one that people love, then they're all that much more capable of carrying out your commander's intent.
Well, I think, you know, when you think about commander's intent, like you just mentioned, the aspect, other aspects of it, or the components of it, the commander's presence, the command climate, you know, those are, it's a situation where I think, you know, when you think about the commander's intent, it's like one specific thing. I mean, it is specific. It may be a big battle with, like, obviously, like you said, D-Day, but I'm saying it's got specific goals in mind. It has a specific end state.
Sure it does. It better.
But over time, when you repeatedly are able to fully complete your commander's intent with the right climate, mm-hmm, and the right presence, when the subordinates underneath that start buying into it and that trust comes into play, then what you have is it becomes a culture.
Oh, yeah.
It becomes a culture amongst.
Oh, yeah.
And when that happens, that's when you start to see the prime opportunity for leaders to come forth, and they become more empowered. And then you literally can honestly step down and go, okay, here's my new battalion commander. Here is my new, you know, and you're fully confident that. So the intent becomes almost like the intent on exponentially, you know, it's,
sure.
It is a culture that will develop. Obviously it's going to be specific to the task at hand, but we're always going to have that culture now because we're buying into the system and we respect the presence and we believe in the climate.
And you believe in the mission. Sure. All of that. I mean, you're dead on. That's really what we're talking about here. I mean, when we say command climate, we really are talking about that culture. And again, this permeates. I don't care if you work for an office in Kansas City with IBM, or whether you're working for a brigade in Afghanistan, you know, Helmand province, it doesn't matter whether it's military model or not. The fact is, it permeates, that culture permeates the entire structure.
Sure. Well, you know, and fundamentals come into play too. Fundamentally, how you, good habits and things of that nature, which I know is taking quite a steer from commander's intent, but it's funny when you talk about how important it is to express that end state, and then, like I said, then, you know, you have your intent, not just your intent, but like I said, your commander's climate and the presence. But, you know, I've always said this about, this is more of an industrial application of that kind of leadership.
Go for it.
You know, let's just pick a restaurant, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, I think sometimes the climate, and you have to be careful about, you have to be hesitant somewhat about saying that my climate is automatically a culture. Because it's not, in my opinion, until you get the buy-in.
Oh, that's a good point.
So, you know, you can go into your kitchen and say, okay, I want to have all my employees to avoid accidents and to make a better work environment. We're going to use please and thank you. And I'm right behind you and I'm right next to you. And that's your climate. That's your intent. Your presence is there. But until they buy in, the subordinates, the people that you're trying to get, until that point, it's not a culture yet.
Uh-huh.
It becomes a culture. And I'm not going to necessarily say that that's the way that the military breaks.
Well, no, but down. I think, I don't know if they make that distinction, but I appreciate it and I buy into it. I think you're right. I think that's a challenge for every commander as they take over. You know, there's always the new incoming boss, right? And so whenever a commander takes over, he or she not only has to establish the climate and their presence, but you're right, they're waiting for people to buy into that. And there's all that there's a new sheriff in town. You're right. It takes a while for people to buy into the new climate.
It's an interesting psychology in itself.
Yeah.
You see that with sports psychology, certainly, which is all about team building. And
absolutely.
Certainly, I don't know that there's probably a coach in America that's probably really used the commander's intent, although I will say that Greg Popovich was an ex-military NCO of San Antonio Spurs. Won 3 championships in 5 years in the NBA.
Really?
I'm not going to go into that.
Really? Yeah. Hey, fantastic.
Not only was he, actually, you know, it would be an interesting thing to really get inside his front office because it's funny you start talking about development and, you know, and the leadership and things becoming a culture because literally the rest of the NBA just, I don't know if the right, this is an offensive word, but literally raped his front office. Every one of his assistants was being hired as a manager for another NBA team, as a coach or an assistant coach, or, you know, he was just feeding the NBA. They're like, what are they doing over there in San Antonio? Well,
right.
But again, like an ex-first sergeant, as a matter of fact, Greg Popovich.
Wow. Yes. And so, of course, he's accustomed to that fostering, that mentoring role. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what an excellent leader does, is build subordinate leaders that can replace him or her. Absolutely.
And commander's intent certainly is, you know, in a little isolated.
Sure.
You know, sure. Is a prime opportunity for that to be happening.
I think it is because, you know, when we talk about your vision, we do have to have the immediate, okay, what I envision achieving today. But you can't forget that you also need to be able to talk down the road. What's going to happen in 6 months? What's going to happen in 5 years? You have to be able to express those visions as well. Visualize, describe, direct. The means by which you do that, commander's intent. And, you know, to a lesser degree, but significant degree, commander's presence, command climate. This is how you communicate that. So, yeah, absolutely.
So your commander's intent could be something that really sets a par course for the year, a performance level for a bigger period of time. It's not just necessarily one battle for them. It's like, you know,
no, absolutely.
It could be a policy, literally.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can set goals through commander's intent. You can set goals for the next year. Sure. You can, I don't know if they're measurable goals or not that it, when you describe beyond a year, but you can. You can say, look, my intent is to bring, you know, over the next 5 years, over the next 3 years, to bring our sales up to this, or to expand our business in this way, you know, to build our franchise as such. I mean, yeah, I think you need to do that for people. I think that needs to be done so that they see where the small victories they have and setbacks, hey, we have to gauge that against, you know, the milestones to achieving that greater goal.
Now, and when you talk about small unit tactics, do you see that same thing? Do you see?
Absolutely. Now, it might be more intuitive. Let's get down to the nitty gritty, Triple D, and that, let's just say this. I mean, if your squad is headed off to the Korangal Valley for 12 month tour in Afghanistan, you might say, my end state is that we all make it back alive. It can be that primitive. But yes, I think an effective squad leader, okay, I think an effective squad leader says, and when we get home, you know, Smitty, I'm getting you to the next NCO Academy, and Johnson, I know you're getting ready to get out. I'm going to make sure that you get into the best school that you can to. You're going to use your GI Bill. I think they talk in those terms. Absolutely they do. Absolutely they do.
And again, that's an end state.
You bet it is.
That's commander's intent. You know, we could go on and on about it transferring over into other fields, and certainly that there's plenty of room for that. But it's funny. I spent 8 years in the military myself.
Oh, I know you did.
and it's so awkward in a way for me to come out, and when we talk about commander's intent, it's one of my favorite things to talk about, first of all.
Oh, yeah?
It's probably one of my favorite shows that we've done. But also, one of the biggest reasons why is it's so stunning. I mean, it's shocking to you, like, why didn't I see this before?
Yeah.
You know, and what are we talking about doing? We're talking about vocalizing a vision. We're talking about the right way to vocalize our vision. Where it is specific. Commander's intent is specific, like you said. But I think, like, somebody on the outside in, looking in could react to it in a way of like, it's just what you want to have happen. Well, what's the big deal about that? Now, using the commander's presence, having the command, not the climate that right. you want, to fully express that and make it an objective base, like a driving force amongst all your troops at every level, brilliant. Yeah. Totally different ballgame. No, it's not just what do I want to see happen. It is, but it has the other aspects to it. And also, there's the difference between knowing a path and walking a path, too. It's that same thing. I have this vision. It's like you said, it's an idea in my head, but can I clearly get it across? Mm-hmm. And now do I have all 250 men in my command totally dedicated and sold in on it, bought in on this?
Sure.
And I just think, all the things that I did within that very military system that I just like, where was this before?
Well, honestly, it was there, and who's kidding who? Some leaders use it very effectively. Some are mediocre, and some are just terrible at it. Now, the good news is that if you stay, at least the theory is, you'll eventually get to enough leadership schools and academies that you'll develop this. Mm-hmm. It can be learned. It can be taught to a lesser degree, but it can be. You're right. It can also be incredibly subtle if you're not tuned into it. Even when it's done effectively.
Sure.
Yeah.
Doesn't have to be a lot of whistles and bells.
Right. Okay.
Chris, I've enjoyed it. It's been great to get back with you again and get down and dirty with some of this.
Yeah, it feels good. It feels good to, what was our break? We were off about 18 months. You don't know how many people came to me and said, why aren't you doing Battle Rattle? I'm like, okay, we'll get back to it. Yeah. Yeah, it's great to get the OD Journal back up and running this year and get back to Battle Rattle. So.
Sure. You have some forthcoming articles coming out on the OD Journal or anything that you want to talk about?
We have. And listen, next time we come back, we will talk about the East Wind event, which is going on right now as we speak out in northeastern Oklahoma. It's a full 9-day simulation. They use the airsoft platform, but if you've ever been to East Wind, which platform you're using isn't even a secondary consideration. It's not. It's a tertiary consideration. That is one heck of a simulation. It's immersive. It's so realistic. I went out there for the last 3 days and was training the Soviet side. Just an incredible group of guys and phenomenal amount of. It's not enough to say realism, just the hardware and the equipment you get to see. I worked with East Germans, I worked with Russians, and when I say, we actually had a group of Russian, some were Russian soldiers working with them, so just a phenomenal simulation, just a phenomenal event, and I don't know anything else like it. It runs training for about 3 days of the 9 days, and then kicks into a 5 or 6 day non-stop, round-the-clock mission. You just keep going.
You mentioned equipment, but they're exposed to East German tactics and doctrine.
Whoa, yeah, East German tactics and doctrines and command structure and culture. They even try to use as much of the verbiage and that they can get away with.
Really?
And when I say it's there, you've got East Germans and Russians on one side. On the other side, you've got Americans, British, and West Germans all bunched in and. And oh my God, they had Brits there. Okay, they have Brits. They were talking to, I don't know if the Germans came, there was a contingent of Germans that wanted to come play the West German side. And Triple D, I'm talking armor. I'm talking East German armor, British FV-432s, not one, but a couple of them, Ferrets, multiple, Ferret scout armored vehicles, machine gunned up, and oh my gosh, you just can't believe this. You walk into these bivouacs with GP mediums and GP smalls all over the place, 2.9 or 2 antennas running up. These guys are talking miles out and running patrols miles out for days and days on end for a full week. It's just phenomenal to see the size and magnitude of this thing. And so when we come back, I want to definitely talk about the experiences there. Hopefully, we'll get a member or two of the guys who run the Eastwind event. But that's what we've been at. And so you say, what have we been running? Frankly, I don't even know what my next thing is. I think OD Journal will be building. We'll do some stuff for some small unit tactics and then for April. And then May, we start building up to the D-Day event, a very similar kind of, well, not as immersive in that nature, but a huge, the world's largest paintball game there in Oklahoma as well. It's a full week-long thing. What we did in March then and February is we built up to Eastwind with a whole lot of leadership stuff. It was commanders, critical information requirement, decision-making articles, and stuff like that for that higher level of the small unit tactics, literally for company commanders, platoon leaders, that sort of stuff. Now, for D-Day in May, start looking for battle staff. OD Journal will be putting out articles on battle staff in support of that.
Excellent. We'll be looking forward to that. And, of course, something else OD Journal will be doing is hosting the podcasting of Battle Rattle Radio. We're back.
That's right.
It's going to be back. Well, so tune in next week, of course, here on Battle Rattle Radio, of course, a part of a division of TACCOM Media hosted by OD Journal. We'll be talking a little bit. We'll be definitely covering the Eastwind event and some other doctrine involved, probably something related. And
absolutely.
Who knows what we'll get into.
Okay.
Chris, I've enjoyed it. It's good to be back.
Yep.
We'll see you next week.